Okay, I think everybody's here. Thank you for being here. Honestly, I didn't expect that many to be here tonight. In a way, I was hoping I can stay warm. But I'm warm here, so that's good. But glad you're here tonight. So we're studying religions tonight, comparative religions. And I think probably if you're in college, this is going to be very exciting, maybe something new to consider. Maybe the older ones have already have some experience. Okay, so I have studied religions before, but never in the way of comparative religions. This is new to me. And as I understand it, comparative religion is just putting side by side some of the major religions with Christianity. So since it's November, we have 2 Mondays. And I missed last Monday, so ideally it wouldn't be really good to, you know, do 4 different topics. Tonight we're starting with Judaism, and then of course next week, Lord willing, will be Islam, and then the following week, since we only have 3, we have 1 last session. You know, I still don't know which one I'm going to do, either Hinduism or Buddhism, one of those. But we'll see where we go. We'll play by ear. But at least we're going to cover Judaism in general and Islam as well. And we'll see about the 3rd session what we can do. So Judaism is still being practiced nowadays, okay, as a religion. So as the way I'm going to approach it is just a background of the religion as it exists today, okay? And a lot of it overlaps with what already we know from the Bible. For instance, if you meet a Jew, which honestly I have not met personally very many because of the, you know, area where I live and the places where I go, and I do wish to meet more, you know, Jews, more Muslims. I want to, you know, meet them, talk to them. Remember, I went to a gas station in Memphis, and there was a Muslim running that gas station, and we got conversation going, and it was really thrilling to me to see how many words in common we had in from Arabic and Spanish, because, you know, Arabs conquered Spain for, I don't know, maybe 400 years or so, and there's a big influence of Arabic in Spanish. So a lot of the words we say in Spanish, they're just copied from Arabic. They're just, you know, they're from them. So it's very interesting. So we have that point in common. But if you think about a Jew today, by the way, I don't know many Jews, but I do have been to synagogues in the States for their, you know, Sabbath services. And maybe that will help spice a little bit the discussion tonight from my experiences. But anyways, if you meet a Jew today, he's not going to be so concerned about being saved as we Christians see it, salvation. He's going to be more concerned about keeping the law. And that thought of being rewarded for keeping the law, they don't like it because they think it's immature to think about keeping the law because of a reward you're going to receive. The way they see it is, I keep the law because I love God and I fear God, not because of the reward or punishment that I may receive. So first and foremost is for them to keep the law, okay? So, and they, Judaism basically is a religion based on relationships. They value relationships. You know, Adam and Eve at first, they lost. What did they lose when they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden? They lost their relationship with God, okay? So that's the way they see it. So they see relationships are very important. So it's God relationships with the human person, a person's relationship with God himself, and people's individual relationships with each other. That's what they see. And then the chosen nation's relationship with other nations. So it's relationships. So all these relationships are based on rules and traditions. Okay, rules and traditions. And they originated from God. Okay, that's the way they see it. All right? So they don't really focus on necessarily on a set of doctrines or plan of salvation, but instead, prescriptions for living. How do you live your daily life? Okay, based on the scriptures. Okay, and the crucial question for them, if you were going to summarize it, is what do you practice? What do you do Okay, what are you doing with your life instead of what do you believe? For them, it's more about practice than what we believe or what they believe. It's more about doing, and the doing comes from the we'll see from where it comes eventually, or it comes from the scriptures. But they have other traditions that were added along the way to their scriptures. There's many different divisions of Judaism nowadays, but the common denominator among them is what difference do you make in the world through righteousness. That's the way, you know, everybody's on the same page on that, okay? So we can divide the history of Judaism as far as, you know, the books and history divides it as the first Jewish Commonwealth and the second Jewish Commonwealth. Some believe that there's a third Jewish Commonwealth, but we will not, I don't think we'll get to that one. We might mention it. But the first Jewish Commonwealth is something we're already acquainted with. We were Christians. And it begins, the first Jewish Commonwealth begins from the time Moses received the law, okay, at Mount Sinai. We're talking about 1400, you know, before Christ, some of that area, until the destruction of Judah and exile under Babylon, okay, which was 587 actually before Christ, okay, from Babylon, all right? So then in that first Jewish Commonwealth, we have several divisions. You know, they consider the early period from Adam, okay, moving forward, and we know the story of Adam and Eve, and then Cain and Abel, how Cain killed his brother, and then from that, the story of Cain and Seth, okay, how the two lines were divided, the children of God and the children of man, okay? Two divisions were there, and then came the flood, okay? So we have all of this in common ground with the Jewish, beliefs or scriptures, okay? And then, you know, with after the flood came the Tower of Babel. So I'm just going, you know, briefly over just major points on the story. This is the, what they consider the early period. Now, they also have the patriarchal period, which is very close to what we have. As a Christian, we see the patriarchal period from the beginning, all the way from Adam, all the way into the law was given to Moses, okay? And it's similar right here, but they kind of reckon it from Abraham on, and so, and more or less, okay? So we see the patriarchs and how in the Fertile Crescent, you know, which is the area, you know, where Palestine is and there's Babylon, we see all this crescent. Now, there was all different type of religions going on, okay? But still, you remember, if you go back from Abraham, as the story develops, you know, there's still the notion of the one God who created all, okay? Although man's tendency was to make religion complicated and start, you know, developing idols and so on and so forth, but still that thought still continued to the point that we see Abraham in a land of religious idolatry, and he believed in the one true God, okay? He was monotheistic. And we're going to see people like Melchizedek as well, who came out of the, you know, just suddenly in the story of Abraham, and he was a priest of God, okay? And so we have those, that patriarchal period. And then during that time, of course, as we remember, religious worship consisted of animal sacrifices, okay, that the head of the family, the head of the clan, made on behalf of everybody else. And you know, Job is part of that. Everything, you know, indicates that he was also a patriarch. Okay, now we have Egypt and in Sinai, and these were 400 years that more or less that they were, you know, slaves in Egypt, and they developed as a nation, okay, in that time. And then something that Joshua 24 and verse 14 tells us is that while they were at Egypt, many of them forgot about the one God. And, you know, they became acquainted with idolatry, and they took hold of it. And that's what Joshua told them. I'm going to worship the one true God, but not the gods that your families worship. Okay, so then along comes Moses, okay? And we're going to see, you know, beginning in Egypt, some of the major significant points in the history of Judaism are going to develop right then. And one of them, for instance, is, you know, the 10 plagues of Egypt that ended with the death of the firstborn sons, okay, and the establishment of the Passover, and which is, if I'm not mistaken, one of the most important celebrations, you know, if for them, even today, the Passover, okay, is one of the most important feasts that they still, you know, keep in mind. So we see also the Israelites crossing the Red Sea, and this is the event that marked them as a separate nation. You know, they're already a nation, they're mingled with the Egyptian idols, but now Moses comes along, leads them out of Egypt, and then as they're exiting or fleeing Pharaoh, here they come behind them. And we see one of the greatest miracles, if we have not seen already the 10 plagues, but he's a great miracle that happened here when, you know, Moses stands up and lifts up his hand and his staff, and the Red Sea, you know, parts. And then they go through. And this is the beginning of them as they see them as a nation now after they cross. This is our nation. This is now we're the Israelites. This is a defining moment for us. Okay? And then also after that, we have the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. And then, believe it or not, the golden calf incident also is a significant point in their history, because this is going to foreshadow the struggles they're going to face with idolatry from then on until they're conquered by Babylon. And then finally, you know, that's taken away from their thought, you know, idolatry. So we see that incident. And then, so like I mentioned, you know, Aaron was the first high priest, and he was the one, you know, spearheading the worship of that calf and of that golden calf. And so for different reasons, we can think about why that happened, but we will not stop that much in this point. So then we have the period of the judges, the conquest first, and then the judges. And we're going to see Joshua conquering the land, you know, after they wander in the wilderness. And I'm just going really quickly on this history, and then we'll finish with some, you know, other points. And then after they conquered the land, you know, and Joshua passed on, they live this period, you know, they had these cycles going on, back and forth, okay? It was a period where they did not have any religious leadership or political leadership. They were basically on their own, you see? So that's why they fell back, or maybe that's not why, but that's part of their, you know, the environment of why they did what they did. And then, you know, we see this cycle of apostasy, and then bondage to a foreign power, sent by God as a judgment. And then we see them crying out to God for deliverance, and then came a deliverance by a heroic figure who then ruled over them for a time. And then the cycle came over and over again. And then after that, we see the United Kingdom, those three, with the last judge, which was Samuel, judge and a prophet. He, you know, as he was growing old, the people asked him for a ruler, a king like the other nations. So God gave him a Saul, and he ruled in Gibeon. And then after Saul came David, and he governed in the newly conquered city of Jerusalem. And then he made some preparations for temple worship, and he organized the families of the priests. And so we see David doing that capacity. But it was when Solomon came that the temple was finally built in this United Kingdom. And then notice something very important here and this is very significant. It will help us understand some stories in the New Testament. For instance, Deuteronomy 12. Let me read this real quick. After Solomon built the temple, and in fact, sometime before Solomon built the temple, there was a hint from God or an indication that there was going to be a place selected for the temple worship, okay? And God was going to select a city from among all the tribes, and there's where the temple was going to be built. And then, let's see. Okay, for instance, verse 10 and 11. Deuteronomy 12:10-11. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you shall dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave of the offerings of your hand, and all your choice offerings which you bow to the Lord. So we're going to learn, if we keep on studying, we're going to learn that that place was which city? It was the city of Jerusalem. So that explains a lot, because when Jesus met that woman at the well, she was confused, basically, because as time developed, we're going to see then comes the divided kingdom. And the first thing that Jeroboam noticed when he took the northern tribes, he said, wait a minute, I took the biggest part of the division, but guess what? The southern part is where Jerusalem is. What am I going to do? And that's the chosen city. So that when he went to apostasy, he said, well, there's nothing I can do. I'd rather keep the people. So I'm going to build some altars, on the north, on the south, and I'm going to name priests, which are not Levites, just whoever volunteers. I'm going to name my own feasts in these days that I think are pertinent, that they're not the same one as the ones in the law. And so that's the way he kept the people with him. Okay, when people should have, in reality, go back to Jerusalem to keep the feast appointed by God. But that was, the divided kingdom. So we see the northern kingdom. And in general, we're going to see the northern kingdom is going to go to apostasy real quick. Jeroboam started off in the wrong direction. But then King Ahab came along on the northern kingdom and he established Baal worship, as a national worship. He and his wife Jezebel, and then several kings after him, worshiped Baal. Okay, until finally in 722 BC, they were conquered by the Assyrians. Okay, and they were not fun people to be conquered by. They were really cruel. Okay, they really suffered the consequences of not heeding, to prophets like Hosea, Elijah first, Elijah, and several other prophets that, preached in that area. Then the southern kingdom, we're going to see several kings are going to be righteous kings, but they're going to also have their own flaws. For instance, there were some religious abuses. For instance, they were, worshiping various pagan deities on the south as well. They were worshiping that brazen snake, that Moses made. As is mentioned in Numbers 21. And then also they were worshiping in high places, which were unauthorized for them to worship. And then eventually there were some syncretism or, blending of practices in the temple. And Ezekiel chapter 8, verses 14 through 18 mentions this situation. Okay, so the southern kingdom is going to finish in 580 AD when Babylon and the third round of conquering comes and finally, wipes out, the city and conquers and takes everybody captive, most everybody. Okay, and they were deported to Babylon. So that's the finish of the first Jewish Commonwealth. Okay, I'm going to try to, speed up a little bit so we can finish. So the second Jewish Commonwealth, and this is where it kind of is, taking a different direction than maybe what we're used to. But the second Commonwealth, just in general, is from the, from the rebuilding of the temple after the Babylonian exile in 515 BC. Okay, when Ezra and Nehemiah, and they came back and rebuilt the temple, and all the way to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. That's what's known as the Second Jewish Commonwealth. Okay, and we're gonna learn that after AD 70, everything's gonna change from now on for the Jewish religion as we know it today. All right. So just in general terms, we have the exile and restoration part of the Second Jewish Commonwealth, and the Babylonian, they have different policies for the captured people. But when Cyrus conquered the Babylonians, and that's a very interesting story to read about, we see that in the scriptures, they had a different policy concerning the slaves. They would allow them to go back to their own cities and worship in their own way, you know, so long as they were still under them. So that was very right in the right time that that came. And then now there was no longer idolatry by this time. Some of the problems they had was, you know, if you remember with Ezra and Nehemiah, they were intermarriage with some of the, you know, pagan people. That's some of the other different problems that came out now. And then, for instance, a lack of obedience to the law, okay? And then some type of empty ritualism as they approach the scriptures. So then you see, we see different challenges. So we're always going to have challenges. That's the point. No matter in which situation we are, we're done with some. As long as we live, there's always going to be a challenge, okay, for us. But anyways, then after that, we're going to see the Greek, you know, occupying that land of Palestine where the Jews already were. And then you see Alexander the Great came, and his mission was to Hellenize the world. You know, make everybody not only speak Greek, but believe and practice the Greek mindset, you know, the Greek culture. Okay, so when he died, his kingdom was divided, you know, in several of his successors or his generals. And one of them made the Seleucids, okay? And he also kept on attempting. And the Seleucids, by the way, they were the ones who were assigned that region of Palestine. Okay, some were assigned Egypt, some were assigned Assyria, different sections, but the Seleucids were the ones to rule in the Palestine area where the Jews were, and they tried to Hellenize the world, that region by force. Okay? They were very strict in that, and, you know, the Jews tolerated it to a certain point, okay, as they were trying to force that Greek culture. But there was one of these rulers, actually the last one of them, and he's mentioned, and he's very famous, Antiochus the Fourth, okay, which he was called Epiphanes, or the Appearing One, and he was so into forcing the Jews to, you know, be Hellenistic that he went into the temple and he took a pig, okay, and he sacrificed it on the altar in the temple to Zeus, to a pagan god, a Greek god, and that was the ultimate, you know, the Jews tolerated from a long time, but this was the tipping point. They say that's enough. Okay, we can go along with your rules, with what you make us do, but you're not going to mess with the temple. Okay, so that's when, you know, there was a high priest. His name was John Hyrcanus, and he had sons, several sons, and who fought with him. Okay, in fact, when Antiochus, you know, sacrificed the pig, that's when John Hyrcanus jumped up. And he killed those guys who were sacrificing. And then that's where the revolt began. All right? So one of his sons, his name was Judas Maccabeus, or Judas the Hammer. He revolted against Antiochus until they finally defeated him. And then when they defeated him, they enjoyed, you know, about 100 years of peace, you know, of this freedom as Jews. And one of the significant events which still remembered today by Jews, practicing Jews today, is the purification of the temple. In fact, they believe the menorah lamps, you know, in the temple there was a menorah lamp, which is the lamp with seven candlesticks, that it kept on burning miraculously. That's what they believe, okay? And that's what a feast called Hanukkah, which incidentally, by coincidence, falls around our Christmas time. But it's not a Christmas celebration for them, evidently, because they don't believe in the birth of the Christ. So they celebrate. In fact, Jesus celebrated this very feast, which was, you know, inaugurated in during the intertestamental period. If you go to John, let me see, I have it here. It's John 10 and verse 22. You're going to see there the feast. And I'm just reading that single verse. Now when the feast of dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter, okay, it was the feast of dedication. It's called the feast of dedication or the feast of rededication. You know, the temple was desecrated, and it was rededicated by them. And this is a feast that, you know, began in the intertestamental period. But anyways, keep on going. And on this, so we have that story, and I'm just going really, really fast. So right after that came finally the Romans. Okay? Came the Romans, and when the Romans were ruling the Jews, we're going to see three major mindsets on the Jews. One of them was that they, there was a lot of devotion to God. Okay, devotion to God. People were, you know, religious. They wanted to worship God. They were going to the temple. They were doing the sacrifices. They were, you know, bringing the animal offerings, whatever they needed to bring. That's one. There was also a lot of messianic expectation. By this time, the expectation of the Messiah coming was high, you know, to the point, and we're not going to go to them, that we're going to see, for instance, in Acts 5:37 and other places in the scriptures, that there were false messiahs who rose up. And these false messiahs, they had a political mindset on their, you know, when they say, I'm the Messiah, and they drew people with them, and they revolted against the Romans, and they were, you know, suppressed or killed or whatever. But there was a lot of messianic expectation. And also, as you know, there were party divisions as well. So we're going to see these different divisions. For instance, you know, the most known divisions that we know is the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Okay, but along with them, and basically the Sadducees were the ones, you know, not every high priest was a Sadducee, but, you know, or priest, but Sadducees were priests. That makes sense, okay? And on the other hand, when we see the Pharisees, maybe not every scribe was a Pharisee, but those who were Pharisees were scribes, okay? So they, and those who were really not part, they tended to support that party, okay? So you see, the Sadducees were at the temple, and they handled, you know, all the rules that had to do with worship at the temple. The temple was their grounds where they exercised their authority. Whereas the Pharisees, they exercised their authority at the synagogues. Okay? That's where they taught. They were the teachers. They were the ones who knew the law. They were the ones who, you know, had contact with the common people at the synagogues. While the Sadducees, you know, were at the temple mostly. But along with those divisions, let me see, we have also the Zealots. We have the Herodians, okay? And Zealots were basically nationalists. We're going to read about, even after the destruction of the temple in AD 70, there were still a big group of Zealots, and they did a last stand against the Romans, okay? And I'll mention it in a little bit. But also, we have the Essenes. There's another division. And the Essenes are not mentioned in the scriptures, but they're mentioned by Josephus. They're mentioned in history. And the Essenes were the most strict, here we can say, they were most strict of all of these sects. They separated themselves from the cities. They lived in the caves. And it's believed that they, thanks to them, on the Qumran, you know, caves, they're the ones who kept copies of the scriptures. And that's where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. They believe it was a community of Essenes. And you know, these Essenes, they did not believe in marriage. And, you know, if you do not, eventually you're going to disappear, see, if you don't. But, you know, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they, especially the Pharisees, they make disciples. You know, Jesus in Matthew 23 mentions that they went long ways to make a disciple. Yeah. And they made them as twice children of hell. That's what Jesus said concerning them. But they were proselytes. That's the way they found, you know, more people. But anyways, so there were party divisions. And see, I hope I didn't forget any of them. But then, when the destruction of Jerusalem came AD 70, everything changed. Okay? Everything changed. Now we have the Sadducees. What is their role? What is their job if there's no longer a temple? You see, they were discontinued as, you know, their job. They were out of job, out of the sudden, in AD 70. Okay? We see the Essenes, they were going to eventually disappear because they, you know, they did not believe in marriage. Okay? They didn't have any offspring to continue that tradition. And, you know, the Zealots were going to be put to death shortly afterwards. So the only ones left were the Pharisees. There's the only ones left, and there's the ones who the people started to look up to after the destruction of the temple, and they became to be known as the rabbis, or rabbinic Judaism began with the sect of the Pharisees. Okay, and then so they were the mainline Judaism from then on. Okay, and then so these rabbis, as we know them, they're believed to be the spiritual descendants of the Pharisees, okay, which was one of the religious divisions we stood after the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, but now, real quick, I have here a copy of, let me put it this way, the Biblica Hebraica. Okay, this is the Hebrew Old Testament. Okay, so after, you know, this rabbinic Judaism began, they began to say, okay, we need to put together a canon of books which are inspired. Okay, so they, with the permission of the Romans still in power, what they did was this rabbi, Yohanan ben Zakkai, he's the one who led this work in AD 90. Okay, and him, along other rabbis, they gathered together and they worked on a canon. And by the way, they, you know, the apocryphal books that we see that they're not part of the canon, they're the ones who said they do not belong to the canon. And they put the canon together. And, you know, Christianity came along, or rather, you know, when you know, Christians look for the canon, they also took that canon also as well, as the one we have here in the scriptures and in our English Bibles. But anyways, this they came up with these Hebrew scriptures, and it's basically divided in three sections. It's different from the way we divide it, okay? And this is divided in the way the Jewish... This is, I guess this is written for a Jewish, I guess, you know, reader. I mean, I think it is because it's all in Hebrew, but it's also divided in the Hebrew way, in the Jewish way. So the three main divisions that they have, it's... first we have the Torah, okay? Which are... The Torah is the heart of their study. Okay, they put the Torah, you know, above everything else. There is the heart of their synagogue worship, the Torah. Okay, so the Torah basically is the five books of Moses, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And if you don't know, maybe this is a good, you know, side note, you know, the books, you know, take the name of the first, you know, word on the book. And, you know, the book of Genesis means Bereshit, which is in the beginning, okay? And you keep on going, and then the Torah, they take the names of the, you know, the first word of the book. For instance, let me see Exodus right here. We have... Shemot, okay? That's the name. So we can keep on going, but if you see, it's backwards. You know, I'm going from... what is it, from left to right, and it's basically backwards, but it's very interesting, and maybe it's more or less how it looks. But I guess if you're a modern, you know, Jew, you might have a copy of this at your home, but they read this from scroll. When you go to the synagogue to worship, they're not going to take this, you know, with them on the arm. They're not. They don't do that. In fact, I don't think they take anything with them, because you go to worship, they go and they have already some booklets, you know, like hymn books, where everything is in order the way they're going to proceed, okay, that Sabbath service. And then I'll explain this in a minute, but they're going to read from the scroll, okay? So the second division is the prophets, okay, which is the word Nevi'im, okay, Torah, the first one, then the prophets. And then they have two divisions in the prophets, the early prophets and the latter prophets. And the early prophets are Joshua, Judges, okay, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. And then they have the latter prophets, which are Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12, in that order. Okay, that's the order that they have. Interesting that some of the prophets that we consider prophets did not make it to the their prophets list, but they're in the rest of the books, which I call the writings, the ketuvim, from the word to write. And in the writings, it's all other books, okay, which were not in the first two classes. And it's, of course, the book of Psalms, Job, Proverbs, Ruth, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, Esther. And then we have Daniel, which is in our Bibles, one of the prophets. We have Ezra, Nehemiah, and it finishes with 1st and 2nd Chronicles. So if I turn to this book, the very last book is going to be, you know, 2nd Chronicles at the very end. Okay, that's the way they have it ordered. Okay, and that's significant because this is the Bible that Jesus knew. This is the order that, you know, that they were used to. But anyways, okay, now, as we keep on going, these are the fundamental writings. Okay, let me just make this point. I know that time is running short. But as the time went on, you know, once they had the canon, okay, they really respected this book just as it was. Okay, just as it was. They didn't want to add or subtract or anything, but what happened is that they were, you know, spread among the nations. Okay? And in fact, they, you know, persecution in that area, and then they moved to Babylon. Babylon became a major hub for Jews. Okay? But what they did is they started compiling because of the, you know, the dispersion, they started compiling the oral traditions of the rabbis concerning the Torah, okay? So they came out with what is called the Mishnah, okay? And this Mishnah was, you know, was completed by other, you know, rabbis, like Rabbi Judah, the prince, okay? And at about AD 200, and, you know, this basically had six divisions on, you know, seeds, which means laws and agriculture, feast, laws concerning holidays and the writing of scrolls, women, okay, concerning marriage and other vows, damages, civil and criminal laws, as well as prohibitions concerning idolatry, holy matters, sacrifices and laws of the temple, the impurities. That was the last section, which had to do with ritual cleanliness and purification. So so what it meant, this Mishnah were comments compiled by different rabbis, which, you know, were questions. For instance, what does it mean that the house be without leaven? What if I have something that has leaven? How can I purify my home and have it without leaven on the Passover day? And, you know, they give those answers on the Mishnah, okay, concerning. And it wasn't necessary was the final authority on every question that they had, but it was, you know, a matter of, okay, this rabbi said this, and that rabbi said that concerning that question, so here are the two options, and it's up to the reader to decide what to do. But there were minor, you know, details, you know, or questions concerning, you know, the Torah. And I'm talking about the first five books, okay? That was the Mishnah. Let's see. So the purpose of the Mishnah was not to give simple expositions or definite answers, like I said, but just, you know, weigh the different opinions of the rabbis concerning a topic, okay? And then, let's see. And then after that came another group of, you know, of comments. Where the Mishnah was more about the, you know, the process of doing it, there came another set of comments gathered along the years, which called the Gemara. And this Gemara was more of stories or examples of how people fulfill those laws, how they did what the questions were asking about. So we come up with this book, which is called the Talmud, okay? And it's, you know, it's the Torah with the Mishnah and then the Gemara. So it's a big, big, big volume. So in English, for instance, let's see, I have an example here. Of course, we have in this Talmud, we have two versions, the Palestinian Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. And in English, let me see where I wrote that down. Okay, it's right here. In English, for instance, this the Babylonian Talmud, which is the biggest one of the both versions, it was finished in the 5th century. The English translation is composed of 17 volumes, okay, plus an index volume, okay? So in just three verses, for instance, on a verse on the Passover, three verses, the Mishnah might have 5 pages, and the Gemara might have like 100 or maybe 200 pages. On just three verses, you know, a lot of comments concerning, you know, a few points. Now, along this time, or maybe before, something that I didn't mention is that, you know, when Jesus talks about the traditions of the elders, something that developed and is still practiced today by you know, believing Jews, is this hinge around the law. So they said, if you know, touching this pulpit is prohibited by God, then we're gonna prohibit approaching the pulpit 5 steps away from the pulpit. You see? So if I broke this law, I'm breaking a law that man made, and I'm protecting myself from breaking that other law. So that's what was the, you know, the traditions and the, you know, the hinge they put around the law. Okay, and this came all the way, you know, before Jesus' time. I forgot to mention that. Okay, we're moving along the time already, but anyways, let me make it more practical as the time finishes. Okay, significant practices nowadays. All right, and you know, time is so it's not a lot of time, so let me see what I can do. Okay, they believe the study of the Torah first and foremost. Okay, that's what they believe. So you go to a synagogue, and then in fact the synagogue is based on a calendar. You know, they meet every Saturday, and this calendar begins at the first year of the religious calendar, which is the Rosh Hashanah. Okay, that is a new year, which is already happening in September, October, and it varies. And then when the new year comes, the next Saturday they begin to read the book of Genesis. And they go all the way around with a reading schedule that when the year, next year comes around, they finish reading the last part of Deuteronomy. Okay? And so you come to a synagogue, the first thing they're going to do, you know, they're going to read some blessings from the Psalms or chant them. And then what they do is they have, in a synagogue assembly, in a synagogue temple, they have something they call the Ark, in a reference to the Ark of the Covenant, which is basically a closet. You have the pulpit, you have a closet. If you open that closet, you're going to see several copies of the you're going to see the scrolls. They're going to be hidden in that closet. So they come to worship, they sing some chants from Psalms, they open the closet, and they get a copy of the Torah, which is really adorned. You know, it's not just the scrolls like that, just very simple. They're adorned, they're covered, and the covering has, you know, it's really nicely embroidered. They has some, you know, images and colorful. And then what they do is they parade it around the assembly, okay? And what I saw them do, you know, when we were at one of those worship services, is they, you know, they have that sacred hymn book that they use. So as a Torah, let's see, this is a scroll. And, you know, two men, you know, hold it, and they parade it around like if I was going to every... And they don't touch it, you know, they grab it by the handles. So they took that sacred hymn book, and they touched the Torah scrolls, you know, still clothed, still on the covering, and then they kissed it. Okay? They kissed the book. Alright? They don't dare to touch it. Alright? But they, you know. So that's what they do. They finish doing that, parade the scroll. They finally, when everybody has an opportunity to do that, they, you know, unclothe it, take away the covering. They put it on the pulpit, and they set it on the right passage for that day to read. And then the reader can be anyone from the members, and they don't, you know, as we're reading, I'm reading here, and I don't want to lose my place, so I use my finger. Well, they read it in Hebrew, but they don't touch the scrolls. They have, you know, a little pointer, a little hand on the top with the index finger pointing like that. So they grab that, and if they need to follow along, they use that. And they read that verse for the day in Hebrew. Okay, that's what they do. And then after that, they sing that portion. And then after they read that portion from the Torah, they read an excerpt or a portion from another part of the Bible, usually the prophets, okay, which has to do with the reading of that day. Okay. And then after they do that, a rabbi comes and he delivers a sermon, you know, where he, you know, explains and expounds on the reading of the day, and you know, gives practical application. Alright, the rabbi. Then after he does that, the Torah is returned to the ark, and the prayers and blessings are pronounced for the nation, for the state of Israel, and for those mourning. Okay, and then the service finishes with what they call the kiddush, or a blessing over a special bread and wine. You know, I didn't know what was going on at first, but they had at the foyer, they have a table with unleavened bread and, you know, little cups of wine. Okay, and they do that at the end, and some of them take it, some of them not. But anyways, moving on, that's a general synagogue worship. Okay, a general. In fact, when I went there, one of the first synagogues I went, you know, I had my camera and I was ready to film, you know, take some pictures, and, you know, this old type of camera. We didn't have those type of cell phones back then. I was in college back then, but anyways, I was ready to take some pictures and, or maybe, you know, record a video. And professor said, he said, don't even, you know, click the shutter, because that's is Sabbath day, and they don't do that. It's Sabbath day. It's work. So you're gonna be disrespecting them. So I kind of, you know, I was very tempted to still do it anyway, you know, to keep it as a memory. But I said, I want to respect that, and just went along. So nowadays there's, you know, Orthodox synagogues where they're gonna speak Hebrew mostly, and they're gonna be more, you know, Reform or all the type of synagogues where they speak the language of the country where they live, and so it's in that way it's easier for us to understand what's going on. But anyways, just to finish, I know I have 10 minutes, might not give us a lot of a break, but just to summarize here, they also, you know, they keep the Sabbath day, that's very important to them. It begins on Friday night, okay, and they have to make preparations before sunset. They have to have their meals cooked for the next day, and several things they have to do. And what they do basically, and there's not a set, strict way in which every Jew keeps it, but in general, you know, they don't do work. They stay home. They read books. They take naps. You know, it's a day of, you know, rest. And of course, not every Jew does that, because not every Jew by code, by nationality, is a practicing Jew by religious. Although both are combined. And some of them, they just take bike rides and so on. But most of them live close to the synagogue so that they can walk and do not violate the distance, you know, prescribed in the law of Moses. They're not going to drive a car to the synagogue in general. They're not. So they take a walk. They live close by the synagogue. Anyways, that's the Sabbath day. They also keep the rules of kosher, okay? And basically the right word to say this is kashrut, okay? But it came as kosher, as the way we know it. And this, of course, it comes from the Leviticus, from the rules of the laws of clean and unclean. And they're very strict with that, okay? They're not, I guess, you know, I've never been to Jerusalem, but I guess you're going to be in culture shock. Do you realize there's no pork and there's no, you know, ham or things that you're used to just eating every day? It's not going to be there, okay? It's out of there, okay? Not even close. And some of them get offended if you mention, you know, ham, pork, and things like that. They're far away from that. But anyways, these laws also had to do with how to prepare food, okay? And then they also celebrate some life cycle celebrations, as we do as well. For instance, one of them is circumcision. But we don't do that, but they practice circumcision. And, you know, on the eighth day, the infant is circumcised. And then when he's circumcised, he's given a Hebrew name. You know, he may already have an English name or whatever he lives. But then he's given a Hebrew name, everybody, okay? And that's the way they're going to be called at the synagogue when they come to worship. And then something they believe is that parents are accountable for the sins of their children. Okay? Parents accountable for the sins of their children until they become of age. And for boys, it's 13 years old. You know, they become bar mitzvah. And for girls, it's 12 years old. They become bat mitzvah. Okay? And then after that, the child, they are responsible for their own sins now. Okay? That's what they believe. So on the Saturday of the week of their birthday, they, you know, stand up and they read a section of the Torah, you know, and they, you know, they need to be learning Hebrew. They might live in the States and they grew up learning English, but the 12 years old, 13 years old, they have to know enough Hebrew to stand up and read in Hebrew and give an explanation, brief explanation, you know, of, you know, like a rabbi would do. And then after that, you know, there's a ceremony, there's a reception, and so on and so forth. And now the child is responsible for his sins, okay? And then they also celebrate weddings in a slightly different way. They also celebrate funerals. By the way, they don't cremate, and they don't have open casket, you know, funerals. They don't do that, okay? It's not done. And in funerals, the family, the closest family, they're expected to keep rest for 7 days after the funeral had taken place in honor of the deceased person, okay? And then they, you know, the holidays that we know about, okay? For instance, and by the way, the Jewish calendar it begins from the creation, okay? Which for us will be 3,750 before Christ. So right now, I didn't check, but it is like maybe the year 5,300, something like that, for them, okay? Reckoning from the creation, if that makes sense. So the first year of their calendar is at Rosh Hashanah, September, October, and then they have, a few days later, they have Yom Kippur, okay, which is the Day of Atonement, okay? And then another celebration they have is Sukkot, which is the Feast of Tents, okay? And then what they do nowadays, back in those days, in the days of Ezra, Nehemiah, and, you know, the Old Testament, they would build booths, you know, in remembrance of the wilderness wanderings. Now, what they do nowadays, they still build booths, but in the backyard, okay? So they're going to, you know, bring, you know, different material, build a booth, and then sometimes they eat meals in the backyard on that booth, and sometimes they even sleep, spend the night on those booths. And that's the fear of Sukkot. And then they have the Feast of Hanukkah, which I mentioned earlier, which celebrates the victory of Judas Maccabee over Antiochus Epiphanes, and the rededication of the temple in 164 BC. And of course, they also have the Passover, which is, it can be argued, but it's the most important holiday that they have. And they, what they do in this holiday, they have a meal which is called a seder, okay, which means order, because they do it in that order, okay. First this, then that, and lastly that, okay. And that order, okay, well, that seder is usually done in a private home, you know, with your family or friends. And they usually leave an empty chair, okay, for the Messiah. And then they say, whenever it's over, they say, next year in Jerusalem, okay? You know. But anyways, although they say next year in Jerusalem, they're not really worried about, you know, the rebuilding of the temple. In fact, some of them, you know, they don't really care about the rebuilding of the temple. They know that's the Messiah's work, to come back and establish the temple, which is something very impossible to do, you know, given the political circumstances in the Holy Land. That's something basically impossible to be done. Yet that's like a lock, you know. There's nothing, there's nowhere we can go with that. The temple cannot be rebuilt. That's period. And, you know, physical temple. All right? So, you know, they have bitter herbs, a boiled egg, unleavened bread, and a mixture of walnuts, honey, apples, cinnamon, and so on for that meal. And then they also have 4 cups of wine that they drink, one in turn. And then and what they do, you know, as far as telling stories, they retell the story of the Exodus, you know, when they're participating of that, and God's initial instructions for the Passover. That's what they do, you know, from Exodus 12. And then the last feast that they have is the Feast of the Weeks, okay? The Shavuot, Feast of Weeks, which we know as Pentecost. But it's practiced, you know, Pentecost is one of the feasts where Jews had to go back to Jerusalem and practice at the temple. So it's very convenient, you know, for all the Jews that they don't have to go back to Jerusalem every year. All they have to do is just, you know, practice the Passover and the Feast of Pentecost, and actually the Feast of Booths, also a holiday which was to, you know, go back to Jerusalem, so they don't have to do that. What they celebrate in this Feast of Weeks, they celebrate God's gift of the Torah to the people. You see, it's a different reason nowadays. But anyways, that's just a general... Now, as we compare this to Christianity, you know, the way we can approach this is in the book of Galatians, we're going to see how the law, you know, was taken away. You see how the law was nailed to the cross. And it really impresses me the way, and I like always to read, thinking about Jews, modern day Jews, I like to read, you know, the sermons of Peter, of Stephen, of Paul in the book of Acts, how they, you know, draw from the Old Testament. And they're basically talking to practicing Jews. That's what they're doing. And if it worked back then, that's the inspired approach where we can start off, you know, as we talk to modern day Jews. It's the same, should be the same approach, you know. And I don't know if there's any comments. I did not leave any time. We have a few seconds left. I hope this, you know, hope this gives you, you know, an interest in studying a little bit more and wanting to know more. I do wish to, you know, get to know more Jewish practicing people so I can know the way they think, you know, in person, you know, not only from the books. Understand them better and find better ways to, you know, study the Bible with them, okay? And, you know, the study of world religions is very, you know, rewarding, you know, if you take that approach. Any comments in the last few seconds? I know I did not leave any time for break. I'm sorry. But I guess...
We'll take a break.
Okay, we'll take a break. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Thank you so much for your attention. We'll take you any more time.
Brother Raphael already prayed, so just have at it.
Yes, sir.
I've often wondered, I don't know the answer to this, how those rabbis became the authorized rabbis, that their writings are a part of the Talmud or the Mishnah. What qualified those rabbis compared versus other rabbis? I don't know the answer to that.
That's a good question. You know, but they were, you know, from
Gamma. They had to choose somebody.
Yes. You
know, yes. To them. I mean, they make the arbitrary choice. You see, the Bible says Jesus chose the holy men of God. So it takes out, the Bible takes out the idea of you or I being able to arbitrarily choose your comments above your comments or your comments above his comments.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Which is interesting in Acts 1, how Matthias was chosen.
Yes.
He didn't even allow the apostles to choose.
No.
We're choosing.
The Lord said, holy men of God.
Holy men of God.
So those are people God chose.
That's right. Which means that they met qualifications.
But see, they took that Bible there, the Biblia Hebraica, and they separated it as the canon from the
apocryphal books.
Apocryphal books, and they knew the difference. But why they can't do that anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I appreciate that. I like
point. But it's interesting that those in Judah, because there are some that are even saying, well, it's about relationships, not rules. That's Judaism. It's not about going to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just about just doing right, being a good person. It's about just what you practice, what you're doing in life. What difference do you make toward righteousness? That's what some brethren are even teaching. And that's why they're mingling with denominations. Because if we have these tenets, that means that we can mix and mingle with them because they're just trying to do right. They're good people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and like, you know, Wes, he came out with an article saying it's not about going to heaven. Well, that's what Judaism is.
It's all about relationships.
It's about relationships. Mm-hmm. It's about rules. It's about relationships, not rules.
Let me just be your
friend. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know why? Because there's some major...
Oh, you want to keep it on there?
I don't remember his last name, but
I think he just do his class. That's what I said.